Burroughs texts annexed by the editors. Editor's note. Naked Lunch evolved slowly and unpredictably over 9 tumultuous years in the life of its author, William Seward Burroughs. The novel was not created according to a predetermined outline or plan, but accumulated through a decade of travel and turmoil on 4 continents, and continually edited and re-edited not only by its author, but also by his close friends Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac. It went through innumerable partial and final drafts, mostly in Tangier, Morocco, and took its final shape only when Maurice Girodias told Burroughs in June 1959 that he needed a finished text within 2 weeks for publication by his English-language Olympia Press in Paris. Thus, by its very nature, Naked Lunch resists the idea of a fixed text, and our recreation of the history of its composition and editing has required a careful review of many disparate typescripts in various archival collections, as well as the 2 first editions in 1959, Olympia Press, and 1962, Grove Press, the texts of which are quite different. To understand how Naked Lunch was written, we must look at the life of its author during the decade before the book was born. Burroughs began his first serious book project, now known as Junkie, in spring 1950 in Mexico City. While Junk, as he called it, still had no proper ending, and a year before Allen Ginsberg found a publisher for it, Burroughs began work on his next project, Queer, during 1950 to 1952. Leaving this book also unfinished, he made a 6-month excursion through South America in January to July 1953, constantly writing letters to Ginsberg and already thinking of them as fodder for his next project, Yahe. In summer 1953, Burroughs' first book, Junkie, was published by a New York paperback house, and that fall he joined Ginsberg in New York to work on their South American correspondence. His dreamed-of love affair with Ginsberg did not materialize, and in December he sailed to the Mediterranean and, after a short visit to Rome, settled in Tangier. From there he wrote often to Ginsberg, who encouraged him and acted as his long-distance editor and agent. Seizing on the lifeline of Ginsberg's interest and attention, Burroughs emphasized their shared literary project and poured out his best material into the letters. As he wrote on June 24, 1954, "Let's get on with this novel. Maybe the real novel is Letters to You." In late 1954, led on by Kerouac to believe that Allen wanted Bill to come live with him in San Francisco, Burroughs returned briefly to New York and then to his parents' home in Palm Beach, Florida, on a mission of reunion. But he never made it to California. Ginsberg rejected him via letter, and he retreated to Tangier, saving what face he could. On December 13, 1954, Burroughs mentions the title of his novel project in a letter to Ginsberg, apparently for the first time. "If there is any possibility of publishing Naked Lunch, I have some notes on cocaine that belong in it, but in the junk section." As editor Oliver Harris explains in a footnote in The Letters of William Burroughs, 1945 to 1959, "At this time, Burroughs conceived Naked Lunch, a title he credited to Kerouac, as a tripartite work consisting of Junk, Queer, and Yahe. His new work, much of which would eventually be published under that title, was therefore considered as separate from the collective trilogy. Although the book's eventual title now existed, it was unstable, and the name of Burroughs's novel project went through several changes before finally being re-established in the winter of 1958 to 1959 as Naked Lunch. There are slightly differing accounts of exactly how this title first came about, but Burroughs always gave Kerouac credit for its coining. Kerouac wrote to Ginsberg on July 14, 1955, urging him to send all of Naked Lunch, titled Naked Lunch, to Malcolm Cowley, adding that he had told Cowley all about how we got to title. Send it as one novel. Stop goofing with this 3-part business. It's one novel, one big vision. The junkie part leads reader on to more complicated works of Queer and Yahe ahead. Years later, in a June 1960 letter, Kerouac reminded Ginsberg of the origins of the title. "Don't hear from Burroughs lately, but was pleased he mentioned I named Naked Lunch. Remember, it was you reading the manuscript, misread Naked Lust, and I only noticed. Interesting little bit of literary history, though." The typescript that contained the phrase Naked Lust became Queer. The phrase does not appear in either of the two final texts of the novel, Paris and New York, nor in Burroughs' 1989 Interzone collection, which includes most of the early routines that he was writing during this time, as well as the full-length text of Word, a key part of the evolving novel but later mostly abandoned. The 1960 letter seems to fix the invention of Naked Lunch as a collaboration of Kerouac and Ginsberg. In October 1955, in a letter to Kerouac and Ginsberg, Burroughs improvised a routine on the naming process itself. In passing, he notes how the eels of the Atlantic Ocean gather each year near Bermuda in the Sargasso Sea to mate, and how their anuses seal up during the ocean crossing. Then he takes off. "Say, that's better than Ignorant Armies, Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold, as a title for my Interzone novel. Meet me in Sargasso. I'll see you in Sargasso. The Sargasso Trail. Ticket for Sargasso. Meet in Sargasso. On the road to Sargasso. Sargasso Yen. Sargasso Time. Sargasso Kicks. The Sargasso Blues. Sargasso Junction. Change for Sargasso. Sargasso Transfer. Sargasso Detour. May yet come up with the Sargasso title." It is amusing to imagine that the three main works of the Beat Generation might have been known as On the Road, Howl, and Sargasso Junction. Harris's introduction to the 1945 to 1959 letters, and the letters themselves, make it clear that the content of the Naked Lunch project mutated from week to week and month to month in the Tangier years, and that the flood of letters to Ginsberg would contain the germ of the final text. Burroughs struggled fitfully with the form of his novel, but as he was writing more and taking off in new directions every day, he was unable to master the chaos of handwritten and typed pages accumulating in his garden room in the Munaria Hotel in Tangier. Another obstacle was the narcotics habit Burroughs had wrestled with since New York in the mid-1940s, which, by spring 1956, had brought him to the nadir of his worst addiction yet. With money from his parents, he went to London for the apomorphine cure in Dr. John Dent's clinic, and then on to Venice, where his friend Alan Anson lived, to recuperate. Burroughs was back in Tangier that fall, and he kept sending new routines and letters to Ginsberg in San Francisco, who was planning two long trips with his new lover, Peter Orlovsky, to Mexico, and then to Tangier and Paris. Burroughs was eager to see Ginsberg again, and to renew their co-editing relationship at first hand. He needed help with the sprawling book project that he usually referred to in his letters to Kerouac or Ginsberg as the novel, or the manuscript, or simply the work. When Ginsberg and company arrived to visit Jack Kerouac in Mexico City in November, Kerouac decided to join their excursion. He sailed to Morocco on February 15, 1957, and 3 weeks later, Ginsberg and Orlovsky made their ocean crossing. Kerouac wrote to his agent, Sterling Lord, in late March, and mentioned that he was earning his meals by typing Bill Burroughs' manuscript. When he composed the second part of Desolation Angels 4 years later, describing this period, he wrote that the work gave him horrible nightmares. After telling Malcolm Cowley that Burroughs has just written the most fantastic book since Genet's Our Lady of the Flowers, and it is called Word Horde, Kerouac left 2 weeks later for London and New York, leaving Ginsberg and Burroughs to carry on. Soon, Alan Anson arrived from Venice to join them. In the third week of May 1957, Ginsberg wrote to Lucien Carr. "Anson arrived from Venice to help work on Bill's book. We type and edit vast amount of material in relays, and also farm out some typing, too. Quite a bit done. One whole section of 120 pages finished, and another about equal size to be done this week. Then the harder job of going through his letters from 1953 to 1956, extrapolating and integrating material, autobiography, routines, and fragments of narrative. Quite a job. We work 6 hours a day or more. Goof, drink, lunch. I cook big suppers, live in Jack's old veranda, a great room overlooking Bay and Spain. Expect to begin traveling when manuscript is near completion, maybe work on final stages in Venice and Paris in fall to peddle it to Olympia Press. It's quite a piece of writing. All Bill's energy and prose, plus all our organization and cleanup and structure, so it's continuous and readable, decipherable. We'll start sending out sample pieces to magazines in a month or so. The manuscript they created, and provisionally titled, in April-May 1957, survives. On the top page, Ginsberg has written Interzone Index, and a list of 11 chapters, which are counted at 175 pages. Anson has written below Definitive Table of Contents of Interzone, and a slightly different list of 12 chapters with an appendix. A few years later, Kerouac wrote Property of Allen Ginsberg, 170 East 2nd, Apartment 16, NYC 9, in large hand across the middle. That summer, Burroughs decamped to Copenhagen, where his old friend Kells Elvins was living with his third wife, a Danish film actress. There he worked on the Freeland section of his book, writing to Ginsberg on August 28th, "Only Scandinavia could have catalyzed the great work." He told Anson he had cut the section called Word down to 30 pages. By December, it was down to 20 pages, and by April 1958, Burroughs told Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Ginsberg's publisher at City Lights Books in San Francisco, that he had cooked down that material to 3 pages, and that the whole last section entitled Word is to be ignored. In fall 1957, back in Tangier, Burroughs seems finally to have abandoned the three-part scheme, writing to Ginsberg in Paris on September 20th, "As regards manuscript, I think any attempt at chronological arrangement extremely ill-advised. To my way of thinking, queer and yahe letters have no place in present work. The gap between present work, that is, last year or so, and work before that, is such that I do not consider the previous material as pertinent, and trying to fit it in according to any scheme would only result in vitiating the work. At present I am working on Benway and Scandinavian angles, also developing a theory of morphine addiction." On January 16, 1958, Burroughs joined Ginsberg at the Beat Hotel at 9 Rue Gillecourt in Paris, and for several weeks they retyped the manuscript, incorporating Burroughs's recent changes and adding new sections based upon his research at the French Medical Library on the Rue Dragon. Now the book was substantially complete, and at Ginsberg's suggestion, Burroughs on April 18th sent the Interzone manuscript to Ferlinghetti at City Lights Books, suggesting that the title of the Word section might be changed to Have You Seen Pantopon Rose? Burroughs usually misspelled the proprietary drug name Pantopon in this way, which we have corrected for this edition. Ferlinghetti did not much like the material, and in any case City Lights had not yet published any novels, only poetry, so he rejected it. Over the next 18 months, generally as the result of Ginsberg's campaigning, portions of the manuscript began to appear in small literary magazines. Poet Robert Creeley, editor of Black Mountain Review, published From Naked Lunch, Book 3, In Search of Yahe, in the autumn 1957 issue, actually issued in the spring of 1958. This was the first published appearance of the novel material and of its ultimate title. Leroy Jones ran the chapter Have You Seen Pantopon Rose? In the third issue of Jugend magazine in 1958. And University of Chicago graduate student Irving Rosenthal published excerpts in the spring and autumn 1958 issues of the university's literary magazine, Chicago Review, which he edited. The chapter called The Rube in the autumn 1958 issue, with a provocative closing line, "To be continued," came to the hostile attention of a Chicago gossip columnist, and consequently the Faculty Review Board of Student Publications blocked the typesetting of the winter 1958 issue, which was intended to feature Jack Kerouac, Edward Dahlberg, and Burroughs. Rosenthal and his poetry editor, Paul Carroll, and four other student editors resigned in protest and started a new magazine, Big Table, to publish the suppressed writings. Several hundred copies from the first printing of 10,000 in March 1959 were impounded by the U.S. Post Office in Chicago on grounds of obscenity. The American Civil Liberties Union brought a federal case against the Post Office and finally won in June 1960. Meanwhile, press coverage of the case came to the attention of Maurice Girodias at the Olympia Press in Paris. Although he had rejected the manuscript on two previous occasions, the first as early as 1956, Girodias in June 1959 sent his assistant Sinclair Bell to see Burroughs in his rooms at the Beat Hotel, not far from Olympia Press's offices, to tell him that Girodias must have the manuscript within 2 weeks. He wanted to capitalize on the immediate publicity of the court case. With the assistance of Brion Geisen and Bell, the book was edited and typed on deadline. Writing a foreword in 1978 for a bibliography of his work, Burroughs remembered, "Much of what went into the book had been previously retyped by Alan Anson and Allen Ginsberg in Tangier. The sections were sent along to the printer as fast as they were typed, and I had planned to decide the final order of chapters when the galley proofs came back. Sinclair took one look at the galleys and said, 'I think this order is best.' By some magic, the chapters had fallen into place, and the only change was to shift the Hauser and O'Brien section from the beginning to the end. 1 month after Sinclair's visit, Naked Lunch was out on the stands, setting a record for prompt publication." Although Burroughs in his letters consistently mentioned the title simply as Naked Lunch, the Olympia edition was titled on the cover The Naked Lunch. While that edition was at press in late July, Burroughs wrote to Ginsberg, "I had exactly 10 days to prepare the manuscript for the printers. Pressure welded the whole book together into a real organic continuity which it never had before. The book will be out this week. Realize that in the last month I have edited the entire manuscript, corrected the galley proofs and the final proofs, and designed a cover, and the book is rolling off the presses right now." 5,000 copies were printed in the first days of August. Inevitably, with such a rushed editing job, typeset by compositors who did not read English well, a number of errors crept into the text. Burroughs corrected about 50 of these when the book was reprinted a few weeks later, but a large number remained, most of which were already present in the earlier drafts of the manuscript. Girodias's press specialized in publishing books written in explicit, censor-defying language, whether literary, like Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer, or strictly for the porno market, like Marcus Van Heller's Roman Orgy. And he had a counterpart in New York, Barney Rossett, whose fledgling Grove Press in 1959 made D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover a bestseller. After winning a censorship case over that banned book, Rossett went after the rights for Tropic of Cancer, and Girodias convinced him to publish Naked Lunch. The Grove contract with Olympia Press for Naked Lunch was made in November 1959. Irving Rosenthal, with Allen Ginsberg's assistance, would be Rossett's editor for the American edition. Since Ginsberg was familiar with the earlier, longer, interzone version of Naked Lunch, and still held the manuscript that Ferlinghetti had returned to him, he wrote to Burroughs to ask if some of the material excised from the Olympia edition could be incorporated into the Grove edition. Burroughs thought that this was a good way to make the book longer and agreed in principle, writing to Ginsberg on July 3, 1960, "Insertion of deleted material. Your suggestion seems an excellent solution. Set them up and I will check over." In the same letter, Burroughs agreed to the inclusion of his long first-person letter to the British Journal of Addiction, Letter from a Master Addict to Dangerous Drugs, which was published in that journal in January 1957 at the behest of its editor, Dr. John Dent, and most of which was broken up into numerous footnotes in the Olympia edition of Naked Lunch. In early 1960, Burroughs' article, Deposition, Testimony Concerning a Sickness, had appeared in Grove's literary magazine, Evergreen Review, and this, too, he agreed to include in the Grove edition. Rosenthal still felt that the book was not long enough, and once more asked if Burroughs had any more material to add. Burroughs' reply to Ginsberg on July 20, 1960, was unequivocal, if confusing, after his agreement to the interzone restorations. The Olympia edition, aside from actual typographical errors, is the way the book was conceived and took form. That form cannot be altered without loss of life. Definitely, I feel that no material should be added in the text. Rather than argue the merits of the hundreds of cuts and changes that Burroughs had made to the text for the Olympia edition, Ginsberg, Rosenthal, or Grove's editors simply took the 1958 Interzone manuscript and rearranged it in the running order of the Olympia edition, adding the new sections from the Olympia edition and making a few obviously needed amendments to the 1958 text. Thus, curiously, the Grove edition, finally published in 1962, is based on an earlier version of the text than was the Olympia edition, published in July 1959. Rosset had 10,000 copies of the new edition printed and bound in 1961, immediately plunged him into the defense of dozens of censorship trials, and obliged him to sit on all those copies of Naked Lunch in a warehouse until the situation cleared up. In early 1962, Grove won a key anti-censorship case in Chicago, and in August, at the Edinburgh Writers' Conference organized in Scotland by British avant-garde publisher John Calder, Burroughs' novel made news again when it was defended, amidst heated controversy, by, among others, Norman Mailer, Alex Trukey, and Mary McCarthy. Now Rosset decided to move. He ordered several thousand more copies of Naked Lunch printed, and, after sidestepping the moralistic objections of his usual printer and binder that October, put the novel in American bookstores by late November. Within a month, 8,000 copies were sold. But the censors struck again. In January 1963, Boston police arrested a bookseller offering the novel, though the case did not come to trial until 2 years later. Meanwhile, John Calder published his edition in London in November 1964, using Olympia's version of the title, The Naked Lunch, as it is known in England to this day. A scathing review in the Times literary supplement by John Willett sparked off a contentious debate in the letters section of that periodical. Calder gathered these remarks into a text he called the UGH correspondence and included it in future British editions. Translations appeared in Germany, 1962, and France and Italy, 1964. In early 1965, the literary value of the Grove Press edition was defended in court by Mailer and Ginsberg and the poet John Ciardi, but the judge ruled it obscene, and Rosset appealed that decision to the Massachusetts Supreme Court. Rosset also published an edited version of the trial testimony, The Boston Trial of Naked Lunch, in Evergreen Review in June 1965. The High Court's ruling on July 7, 1966, that the novel possessed redeeming social value, and therefore was not obscene, freed Rosset to republish the book and marked the end of overt literary censorship in the United States. Grove's next edition in October 1966 included the Evergreen Review trial testimony excerpts, added in a bid to ward off future prosecutions. By the spring of 1974, more than 200,000 copies of Grove's Naked Lunch had been sold, and the book had been translated in Japan, 1965, Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, 1967, Finland and Spain, 1971, and Holland, 1972. At this writing, editions have also appeared in Portugal and Brazil, Croatia, China, Russia, and Israel. With more than 1 million copies sold worldwide, Naked Lunch has secured a permanent place in post-war American literature. In the summer of 1998, James Grauerholz was reviewing the large Burroughs manuscript collection at Ohio State University Library, most of which was placed there 10 years earlier when Burroughs made a sale and deposit arrangement with the Special Collections Library. Almost as an afterthought, Grauerholz asked head librarian Jeffrey Smith for a look at any Burroughs papers Ohio State had acquired before 1988, and upon examining these, he was astonished to realize that the minimally catalogued materials that the library acquired in the mid-1960s included a nearly complete set of the final 1959 typescript from which Olympia typeset Naked Lunch, which Burroughs had always maintained was lost by Maurice Girodias. That discovery led to the editing of this new, restored edition. After 1962, there were two perfunctory revisions of the Grove text, one by Grauerholz, one by Stephen Lowe, intended to correct the more obvious typesetting and spelling errors, but the book had never received the thorough textual analysis required to provide a definitive text for future English and foreign language editions. We began by comparing the Grove text with the Olympia edition to identify Burroughs' own post-1959 editing decisions. We compared these against the 1958 Interzone manuscript, which Barry Miles discovered in the early 1980s in the Allen Ginsberg collection at Columbia University's Butler Library, catalogued only as an enclosure, with Burroughs' cover letter to Ferlinghetti. We consulted many jumbled original Naked Lunch first draft pages, preserved in the Robert H. Jackson collection in the Special Collections Library at Arizona State University, where we benefited from the kind assistance of librarian Marilyn Wurzberger, Ohio State's Jeff Smith, and that institution's cataloger John M. Bennett gave us generous and valuable help. We also compared all the portions of the book that had appeared in literary magazines prior to Grove's 1962 publication and, when available, the relevant typescripts held by libraries whose collections include materials from those early magazines. Two or three private collections appear to contain some more material that remains, for now, inaccessible, and undoubtedly Burroughs did lose or destroy many other partial drafts. In any case, our review of textual sources has been as comprehensive as possible. Had we been working in the early 1960s, the job would have been more straightforward. We might have corrected the numerous punctuation and spelling errors in the Olympia edition and reinstated only those words, phrases, and paragraphs that arguably added something to the text. Since then, however, the book as it stands since Rosenthal's 1960 reassembly has entered the canon. The Calder edition differs from the Grove only in the extraneous materials surrounding the main text, and all foreign translations are taken from the Grove edition. We could not, in heedless pursuit of some idea of academic purity, remove portions of the text quoted in long-published scholarly texts, and no long-time reader would be pleased to find that his or her favorite passage had been cut. Above all, and sadly, we no longer have our old friend William here with us to act as the final arbiter of any changes to his masterpiece. But Burroughs himself relied upon the Grove text for years. He read from it at public readings and made spoken word recordings from it. Therefore, the Grove edition guided us. Miles once asked Burroughs if the repeated passages in the book were all intentional. Burroughs replied that they were there by mistake, caused by the rush to get the text to Girodias, these sections being for the most part edited subsequent to the Interzone manuscript from scattered drafts. We took this as authority to remove several repeated paragraphs that were clearly in the wrong place, but left others that seemed to work well in both places where they appear in the text. We corrected scores of spelling errors, mostly proper names of tribes and drugs and anthropological references, and standardized the use of paragraphs. James Grauerholz was Burroughs's editorial assistant for 23 years, and his experience in typing and editing Burroughs's texts and going over them with him during that time was invaluable in knowing how the author would have wanted a passage to read. Allen Ginsberg's Howl may refer partly to Burroughs in these lines: "And who therefore ran through the icy streets obsessed with a sudden flash of the alchemy of the use of the ellipsis catalogue, a variable measure, and the vibrating plane?" We restored Burroughs's use of ellipsis, a form he borrowed from Louis-Ferdinand Céline's Journey to the End of Night and Death on the Installment Plan. These novels were translated into English by John Marks in 1934 and 1938, respectively, during Burroughs's college years, and he is known to have read them. His typescripts employ a curious device of two periods rather than one for a full stop, or three for an ellipsis, at the end of most sentences. We have treated these as standard ellipses. In summer 1959, Burroughs changed the grammar of a number of passages from the Interzone manuscript for the Olympia edition, and these changes we have retained as being his final draft, even if the later Interzone-based Grove edition omitted those earlier corrections. These changes, of tense and number, will be the most noticeable differences in this new edition. Far from being truly naked, this book has over the years become encrusted with an accretion of articles, letters, court transcripts, and other documents. The Olympia edition had none of this. When Burroughs agreed to have deposition testimony concerning a sickness included in the Grove edition, he specifically said he wanted it used as an appendix. We have moved it to the back of the book. Since 1966, the U.S. edition has usually included the Boston trial of Naked Lunch, but this no longer seems relevant to the book. We have excised it, but it remains available to interested scholars. The U.K. edition was encumbered with the TLS UGG correspondence, added after its first publication in 1964, but we have not included UGG, as that exchange is now of historical interest only. With resort to the original typescript sections and fragments, and in particular the long chapters uncovered at Ohio State University in 1998, we have, however, created a new annex of materials, which comprises earlier abandoned outtakes, text fragments lost between the last typescripts and the Olympia edition, perhaps accidentally, alternative versions of familiar passages, and a few contemporaneous writings by Burroughs that, while never meant as part of Naked Lunch, nevertheless are relevant and illuminating. All these texts are gathered here at the back of the book, and they are sequenced to follow roughly the order of the final text passages to which they might have pertained. These first draft typescripts bear many marginal notes, repetitions in an effort to find the right phrasing, strike-throughs, and unclear attempts to indicate transpositions. There are often gaps in sense, which one feels sure the author would have corrected on a second pass, if he ever made one. We have silently corrected only repetitions and misspellings, all editorial interpolations, changes for sense, changes in word sequence, and restorations of struck-out lines are indicated by square brackets. Neither editor can approach this book disinterestedly. Each of us was profoundly affected upon encountering it in the 1960s. Perhaps that lingering dream, that wish that it might not end with the last page, has in some way come true through our painstaking assembly of all the worthwhile unpublished Naked Lunch pages we could find. If so, there is also a certain sadness at reaching the textual outer limits of what Burroughs's novel can ever encompass. But as we read the original book again, for the umpteenth time, we are astonished by its deathless hilarity, insight, and prophecy. Naked Lunch still speaks to us in a voice unlike any other heard before or since. Barry Miles and James Grauerholtz, January 2001. Sources. Burroughs, William S., Interzone. Edited by James Grauerholtz, New York, Viking Penguin, 1989. The Letters of William S. Burroughs, 1945-1959, edited by Oliver Harris, New York, Viking Penguin, 1993. Clay, Stephen, and Rodney Phillips, A Secret Location on the Lower East Side, New York, New York Public Library and Granary Books, 1998. Ginsburg, Allen. Howell, Original Draft Facsimile, edited by Barry Miles, New York, Harper and Row, 1986. Goodman, Michael Berry. Contemporary Literary Censorship, A Case History of Burroughs's Naked Lunch, Metuchen, New Jersey, Scarecrow Press, 1981. Kerouac, Jack, Selected Letters, 1940-1956, edited by Ann Charters, New York, Viking Penguin, 1995. Selected Letters, 1957-1969, edited by Ann Charters, New York, Viking Penguin, 1999. Maynard, Joe, and Barry Miles, William S. Burroughs, A Bibliography, 1953-1973. Charlottesville, University Press of Virginia Bibliographical Society, 1978. Miles, Barry, The Beat Hotel, Ginsberg, Burroughs, and Corso in Paris, 1957-1963, New York, Grove Press, 2000. Ginsberg, A Biography, New York, Simon & Schuster, 1989, Revised Edition, London, Virgin Books, 2000. William Burroughs, El Hombre Invisible, A Portrait, New York, Hyperion, 1993. Morgan, Ted, Literary Outlaw, The Life and Times of William S. Burroughs, New York, Henry Holt & Company, 1988. Letter to Irving Rosenthal, 1960. July 20th, 1960, present time. Cargo American Express, London, England. Dear Irving, first a general statement of policy with regard to Naked Lunch. The Olympia edition, aside from actual typographical errors, is the way the book was conceived and took form. That form cannot be altered without loss of life. Definitely, I feel that no material should be added to the text. I am now writing a sequel to Naked Lunch called Mr. Bradley, Mr. Martin, in which I will use any material from the manuscripts that Allen Ginsberg has which seem pertinent. But I repeat, none of that material should be added to present text. Above all, the present ending should not be altered. In fact, there is little of the old material that I will use anywhere. It is understanding out of date. Yes, it is definitely my intention that the book should flow from beginning to end without spatial interruption or additional chapter headings. I think the marginal headings are definitely indicated. This is not a novel, and should not appear looking like one. What is the point of chapter headings that merely repeat from the text? In short, I am definitely opposed to any additional chapter headings. On the other hand, I think including the deposition article from Evergreen and the Journal of Addiction article is an excellent idea. In appendix. Also, the enclosed note on cut-up method, which is used in the sequel and illustrated in The Exterminator and in Minutes to Go, both now out in the States. I go into the matter of word forms in the sequel. If illustrations are used, and I think excellent idea, they should be presented with drawings from Brion Gyson, since my drawings were derived from his, which suggests a selection of drawings from Gyson and myself to be inserted at close of text before appendix. Please let me know if Grove is willing to use Brion's drawings, and I will contact him. Certainly I could not use my drawings alone without acknowledging their derivation from Gyson. 18. Sick. Insha Allah means Allah willing. 19. MS, morphine sulfate, hospital jargon. 20. Veganin is codeine aspirin tablets sold at 5 and dime in England, sold anywhere in Europe without prescription. 21. Track is the name I have given to the sex and dream utilities, explained in sequel, now in preparation. 22. It is codinita, Latin American codeine tablet. 23. Sobera de la flor. 24. A oud is a two-stringed instrument like a guitar or mandolin. Nimun is other boy's name, so you never know. 25. No holes barred is correct. 26. Fugue state is period of amnesia. The man speaking cultivates errors of speech for his legend. 27. A reg is a dessert. 28. Meat lack is meat lack. Lack of meat. A meat is a meat, where you meet somebody. 29. Chimborazo is famous snow-capped peak in Ecuador, one of the sights of the world. 30. A rat is a rat is a rat is a rat is an informer. 31. A nanny beater is a beater of nannies, a beater of queers. 32. I do not have copy to hand. Context? Flesh corset. A. Allen Ginsberg's hand. 33. Context? M.I. is initials of party leader. A.G. Ginsberg. 34. A Sabbath is a meeting of witches. 35. A motoscafi is a boat on Venice canals to transport passengers from here to there. 36. Kosk means prepare to make the street. 38. Repeat is intentional. 39. Clutter the glind, since it refers to a type of navigation not yet extant, has no known meaning. 40. A pink scrotal egg. Reference scrotum. 41. An insect that conveys Chagas disease. 42. It is a made-up name for drug, and it should be ST6, because that is the way it was made up. 43. Neighbor is sensible idea, like through, but it makes no never mind. 44. Black yen is correct. 45. A lamp in the form of a cobra, atrocity common in the 1920s and often correlated with pseudo-Spanish subdivision architecture. 46. Come now, Irving. Oh, oh, what can the matter be? Johnny's so long at the fair. You have heard that tune 1,000 times. We all have. No folk song, just an old song around for a long time. 47. The book should end with No glot clom flyde. Explanation in footnote. 48. The Uab days were the 5 days left over at the year's end in Maya calendar. All bad luck of the year was concentrated in the Uab days. The enclosed explanation of the cut-up method should be inserted at the end of the article, deposition, and followed by the cut-up of that article which was printed in contributors' notes. Remember that some of the errors in Olympia edition are intentional. I corrected the book for second printing and found, as I remember, not more than 50 actual errors. Love, William Burroughs. The Death of Mel the Waiter, undated, handwritten, circa late 1953. I remember how I happened to write this book. I had a friend, no, not a friend, a customer more like, Mel the Waiter. Every time he took a bang, I used to service him in his room, you understand. Sounds like sex. Much of junk talk is ambiguously sexual. Lived over on Jane Street in one of those dirty red brick rooming houses. By an odd coincidence, I used to live in the same place when I was fucking Anderson, or vice versa. Long prick of coincidence, feller say. So I remember once Mel took a bang. As I turned around, there he was, blacking out, and the dropper hanging in his arm, full of blood. Then I jerked the dropper out and slapped his face with a wet towel. That is, Richie slapped his face. I didn't know him that well. Understand what I mean? You gotta know a guy to slap his face with a wet towel, you know what I'm talking about? Well, suppose I come in the middle, say, 1,000 years from now. New kicks and a new setup. I could just sit and listen. This is if I'd sabed the talk. And I'd dig the setup or the word for it. For example, there's always a word for fuzz. Reminds me of Faye White and her Sunday language about Phil.
Phil isn't here. He had to go downtown.
Or,
Phil was involved in something that took him to Lexington.
Well, so I figure Mel was going to conk out one day. And in fact, he did. Came out of Lexington clean after taking the cure. This happened to a lot of good people. Not that Mel the Waiter was ever any good for anything. Richie told me how a friend of his died in his arms in Chicago. In Richie's arms, of course. They were clean, more or less, and scored for a junkie on the south side, and the other bum's friend froze, and his eyes rolled back. That's what happens.
I got an overdose once in Yonkers, and Jane said my eyes rolled right back and showed the white scleras at her across the kitchen table like cataracts. But fear not, thou wedding guest, this body fell not down. Well, not that time. Where? When? Texas? New Orleans? Mexico? Anywho, I was thinking of Stan Kenton's Jump for Joe, which seems to expand and expand with black blurs of sound in a great empty barn-like room out into space. So I see Mel the waiter. Somebody wrote me. No, I'd been in New York. That in the winter, Al flipped as visions spilled out on the subway floor and said, "For God's sake, Al, pick him up. We're in a public place. It's a reflection." I mean, there is a point when you say, "What's the matter with you, flipping or something?" And suddenly you see he has flipped. Like in Mexico, when old Garver came over to my moldy fifth patio pad with the impurities of amateur heroin in his brain like spirochetes, and I sleeping there and not hearing about it. 11 o'clock on a clear, bright Mexican morning. So there he is, standing by my bed, cadaverous in a black-blue overcoat, midnight-blue overcoat, and his eyes brighter than I ever saw them, gleaming in the dark, the shades drawn. You understand, I mean, I was sleeping. And he says, "You gonna lay there on your bed with all these shipments coming in?" And I says, "Why not? What else? This isn't any fucking farm." And he got right in bed with me, overcoat, shoes, and all. And I said, "What's the matter with you? You crazy?" And I looked into his bright eyes and saw that he was. Well, it was the same with Al then in the subway. So it was Al told me about Mel on the subway, you understand. It was before that we were in front of a drugstore, which maybe brought up the whole subject. He told me Mel the waiter died, though he didn't remember the name until I put him in mind of it. Died of an overdose after taking the cure at Lexington. So it was later, I think, in New Orleans. I was high on weed and play this Stan Kenton, and I see Mel the waiter on the bed turning blue around the lips. No, it wasn't in New Orleans, because Al was there. Or was he? He couldn't have been there. But I can feel him there. Blue, and the room opening out into space. A neon sign outside the window blinking red-purple light across Mel's face, on and off and on, and the dropper full of blood hanging in his arm like part of the sign and the neon. So that's the end. The long fin, or something like that. But when I started to write, I barely used that idea at all. Outtakes. The Vigilante. Going to see his model mistress on Jane Street, I knocked and said, "It's me, Bill," and heard her turn the key. She stood there looking at me, all the bones sticking out in her face, a little gold ring of iris around suffering black holes of her pupils. I nodded, and she got the works. "Age before beauty," I said. "It's my trap and my works. My bread, most of it, baby. Lest you forget. I filled the dropper and then tossed her my tie. "Go on, tie up." I felt along her arm and slid the needle in. Blood flowered in the dropper like a red orchid. Then I pressed the bulb slow as she pulled the tie loose, watching the junk drain in, the young face take on the ageless forms of junk, the skin smooth, the lids droop. I looked at her without desire. She was no longer a woman. Then it hit me. That sweet stuff seeps through your screaming flesh like water on parched land, lungs aching, legs twitching, acid tears searing your eyes. Now all gone, the trouble and the pain all gone away at the magic touch of the substance, G-O-M. I crossed myself and fell on my knees and went through the junk sacrament while Joan danced the junky jig around the room. I got up and danced the junky jig. Like I say, she got on in Europe, cocaine parties in the toilet of progressive schools in Switzerland, Majun orgies in Tangier, shifty, dirty connection by the canals of Copenhagen. Nobody so dirty as a dirty Dane unless it's a dirty Swede. Her first boyfriend died of an overdose in Oslo. He used to nod out on a quarter grain, something with his metabolism, you know. I nodded. All the dead walking through the room, the sailor hanging from a cell door, his tongue lolling out the way it would fall out when he was loaded on goofballs. "Some things I find myself doing, I'll just pack in, is all," he said to me once. That was back in my bisex salad days. Mel the waiter, overdose after a cure, turning blue around the lips under the neon lights in a cheap hotel, flash on and off, and the dropper hanging to his arm full of blood like a glass leech. So many I hear their sighs and whimpers in junk kick and junk orgasm, half hard, rubbing along the smooth wooden edge of a precinct cell, and a drunk snarled, "What are you doing?" And I looked at him with metabolic hate, drawing myself away. "Leave me the fuck alone, will you?" And he knocked me into a corner, blood running out my mouth, and I wouldn't look at him. Now he is shaking the bars and screaming, "Let me out of here!" I mean, for the jailhouse pest department. And an old red-haired junkie came over and sat beside me with a handkerchief and a cup of water and washed the blood off my face with gentle, larcenous old woman fingers. And I gave them all a sleepy benediction and snuggled down into my junk and went on the nod. About this time I meet this Italian tailor cum pusher I know from Lexington, and he gives me a goodbye on H. At least it was good at first, but all the time shorter and shorter. Short Count Tony, we call him. Order a suit off him, hitch at the knees. But we fill in the short count with milk sugar and start pushing in a small way to feed the Chinaman, serving the young kid junkies he know got landlocked when their man killed himself with acid H in the vein, dried up the city on this clatch. The man wants to touch these wild kids. Young faces in the blue alcohol flame, invaded, possessed by the substance.
"But what do you care so long as you get it in the vein? Here I got a cool shooting gallery for you kids, and what consideration do I get? So long as you get it in the vein, that's all you care."
The pusher sits there eating the young blood, his face in the blue flicker, cruel and sated and sexless. Aztec Earth Mother, priest and agent of junk.
"Say, you're looking great, kid. Now do yourself a favor and stay off. I've been getting some really great shit lately. Remember that brown shit, kid? Sort of yaller, like snuff? Cooks up brown but clear. No, I'm off, and sure, you're off, kid. Now I live just here. Feel like a little joy bang? I mean, one bang never put anybody back on. No need to get hooked at all if you know when to stop and where. Right here, kid."
Back to New York, face stained with malaria and hepatitis, junk is way up and cut to the bone, and the fear flares out of every junkie's eye, flashing on and off like a lighthouse. Get on that boat, junkie. Get out from under. The USA is burned down dust bowl. Cattle and junkies low for relief as they nuzzle the dry opium pipes and empty caps. All ashore, who's going ashore? Hold back that clicking subway door. The old world. The zone. Easy to get in and hard way out. Junk sickness stands at the control box. The yammering boy need intercepts a queen's rush for the airport. The CID warrant waits in Gibraltar. In the gathering gray twilight of junk, shooting every hour, looked at my shoe all day. Gray pictures on a gray screen, fading slower and slower. Your time is running out, almost gone. It was panic got me to the airport and on the plane with an eau de cologne bottle full of junk solution, fixed in the airport washroom at Paris, on to the gray streets of London. Apomorphine puked up my monkey in bloody pieces into a basin carried out. Flesh hangs on the bones, the untenanted body, and then suddenly you are back inside, moving, and I walked through Hyde Park. Venice. Rich yellows and blue hashish in the streets like deep stone canyons, blue doors, yellow lights, little bars where sad old Spanish drunks sniff pensively, tapas and soccer scores on the wall.
Outtakes. The Rube. That's the way the ball bounces. I would usually go in first just to ask the doctor for a hospital address or anything, just so I could get a look at him and hear him talk. Then I planned the strategy, and I was seldom wrong, putting my finger unerringly on the doctor's weak point. Was he a count? Carl was a baron. A Marxist? The Rube had got on junk, with CP and so forth. A few iconoclastic types I tackled myself. Doctors mostly sustain themselves in a medium of false ideas, the word doctor casting about them, so they think, a sort of magical aura. They are all set up for some line of con. When we reached Chicago, there is something about Chicago that paralyzes the spirit under a dead weight of formalism, dictated by hoodlums, a hierarchy of decorticated wops, and everywhere the smell of atrophied gangsters, the dead weight of those dear dead days hanging in the air like rancid ectoplasm. You suffocate in the immediate past, still palpable, quivering like an earthbound ghost, slipping around the corner in a junkie's body, stealing out of a night spot. The old-time jazz, or just the soul of the 20s, disembodied, will hit you in Lincoln Park. Or there on the near north side at Dearborn and Halsted, the feel of the 20s will hit you. And the souls are crushed in the weight of hoodlum formalism, breaks everybody down to the side-of-the-mouth sober order, the studied deadpan poise. Here the dream is suffocating, more real than the real, the past actually, incredibly, invading the present. It's almost like you could reach out and have your youth over again, so solid, nostalgia taking solid form and face. But the fraud is immediately apparent, and the horror, the fear of stasis and decay, closes round your heart. We move on west and south, stopping on red clay side roads to fix at noon in Tennessee, and Carl got out to piss and found a little pink arrowhead. And always cops. Smooth, college-trained state cops, impersonal and polite, with their gray eyes weighing you up and the practiced patter that has no relation with the appraising eyes looking at your clothes, your luggage, your car, weighing and sifting. In Cuernavaca, Joan met this pimpish trombone player, and I could see them fitting right together like a broken coin. Glad to be rid of her. On south. Kicked my habit in Panama with PG. It's easier to kick in a warm place. Sleeping naked, and the whole town looks like a 1910 degraded leech on the canal. Pimps and whores. No habit. On south. And when I walked away from them, I carried part of her inside, half a man, ambiguous, broken. Up a great brown tidal river to anchor at the port city in water hyacinths and banana rafts. The Republic's one gunboat stranded in a mud flat, crisscrossed by sagging catwalks. A young sodder shits through rust hole in the deck and pensively wipes his ass with the flag, watching the boats from distant lands. The town is an intricate split bamboo structure in some places 6 stories high, overhanging the street, propped with beams and pillars and railroad sections to form arcades where the inhabitants can keep out of the warm rain that falls at 10-minute intervals. Ambiguous marica pimps, Negroes, Chinese, Indian, drift under street lamps eating purple ices, lean against outcroppings of limestone, talk in silent, catatonic gestures, frescoes of delicate depravity, flat, two-dimensional Egyptian hieroglyphics. Plaintive boy cries drift through the night. Paco! Joselito! Enrique! Stale patter of commerce. Aver luckies? Nice girl, mister. Panama hats? Squeezed down heads? The best Panama hats are not made in Panama. A hideous soiled mouth blows smoke rings into the night. Smoke, track, cigarettes. They do the work. This is track country, and the track, the sinister sex utilities combine, can shut off the orgones for the non-payment.
The jungle invades the city in great rank, weed-grown parks where armadillos infected with the earth-eating disease gamble through ruined kiosks. The stone liberator, tired horse and tired rider. Stone generals like frozen lunatics advocate liberty under the iguana's eye. The candiru finds its silent, purposeful way into swimming pools. An old Chinese, fine and yellow as an ivory chessman, sits on an anthropomorphic limestone seat, sipping paregoric. The smooth brown loin of the pimp swells and rots with lymphogranuloma. Albinos blink in the sun. Boys sit in long rows under the cool arcades reading comics. They do not move their legs as people walk by. There is something here you never see or find in a silk stocking thrown over a rotten teak wood balcony up under the town's sizzling iron roofs where plants in tin cans grow on perilous balconies. Bureaucrat in a black suit and black glasses, the dull, liver-sick hate congested in his eyes like toad poison. Smell of the tidal river and the mudflats, sewage and drying cocoa beans. Now the vagos jugadores de pelota storm the stale streets of commerce, leaping, back-kicking, and the civil guard discreetly turns away and drops his pants looking for crabs in a vacant lot. For the ballplayers can sound a, "Hey, Rube, bring a million adolescents," breaking all the frontiers through the miasmo river towns of Quevedo and Babahoya, windy, rubbly mountain plateaus, clouds of La Paz, and the mists of Bogota and Lima and the cold, windy mountain plateaus. Windy, dusty mountain towns, thin air like death in the throat, cold mist of Lima that gets down inside you like junk-sick cold, blighted leprosy area of Tolima, hardwood coastal forest, with cities of wanted men, ghost towns of Esmeraldas. A Negro pensively scratches his balls. End of the road towns, Puyo and Mocoa, Puerto Limon and Pucallpa, under silent wings of the Anopheles mosquito. There are sinister roadhouses in the jungle around the port city, stocked with whores, purposeful agents of disease. Dope peddlers lurk in the toilet with loaded needle, dart out and shoot into a tourist without waiting for his consent. The doormen are cops. Expert lush rollers, like all cops of the area, can lift the generalissimo's wallet with a macho goose and club a drunken sailor into the jungle mud. I was studying a small sign on a deserted building, "Down with Track and the Sex Utilities." Dark, greasy men plucked at my sleeve, flashing gold teeth in a little snarl.
"Psst! Seguridad!"
They studied my papers over each other's shoulder, the ones behind leaping up with little plaintive cries. Mosquitoes moved delicate and tenuous in the air. A group of detectives began chanting in unison,
"Comisaría! Comisaría! Comisaría!"
The comandante emerged through a metal door, slapping at a small pistol impatiently. The pistol shifted from one holster to another on little steel tracks. He was sitting in a garage under the street level, full of metal barriers and gates and lockers that swung smoothly on oiled hinges. I noticed that he wore a pilot's uniform. Tin planes rested on his shoulders like monster insects. His face was a mechanic's face, invaded by steel and oil.
"We let the signs stand because we are a democracy, but it is not good to stand and read them."
"You can say that again,"
said a snide liberal journalist with narrow shoulders and bad teeth, standing by a file cabinet.
"You might get yourself on the track list."
"As you may or may not know, track has special police for crimes committed on track premises with extraterritorial rights through the world. I've got it all right here. Take years to write."
The comandante smiled and jerked his head toward the journalist.
"Mucho polito," he said.
He handed back my passport with a heel click. A boy named Joselito moved into my room, suffocating me in soccer scores. We wore the same clothes and laid the same novia, who who was thin and sickly and always making magic with candles and religious pictures and drinking aromatic medicine in little plastic eye cups, and never touched my penis during the sex act. Through the customs checks and police controls, through the pass and down in a blast of safe conducts, warm wind in the face, and three monkeys ran across the road, down into the sound of running water, everybody on the bus high, laughing and talking at once, swinging around the curves over a misty void, and the driver pointed out the white crosses with little brays of laughter, and sipped aguardiente from a bottle proffered by a shy Indian cop.
22 muertos. 2 jóvenes quemados vivo.
¡Viva la sport!"
ejaculates an American queen. 2 cameras dangle on his great bosom, extension and light filters across his breast, seeking the young subject with a dead-tinted eye. He leans back into the seat and squeezes the light filters. Down into the end-of-the-road towns on the edge of Yahe country. Up through the river towns, Babahoya, Quevedo, Puerto Limón, Black Stetsons and the gray malaria faces, color of dirty paper, muzzle-loading shotguns and vultures pecking in the streets. Down from the mountains to buy powder and shot and tonic and aguardiente. Government monopoly. Tastes like kerosene. The sad-eyed student from the capital talked apologies, waiting for the bus to load its cargo of bananas and Coca-Cola.
They have no instruction, nothing to do but drink in this place. Much malaria.
He warned me against the Rio de Oro, one of the many sections in the coastal forest regions that is peopled entirely by wanted criminals. In such force, the civil guard is unable, unwilling, and shit-scared to set a flat foot in the area. The criminals are self-righteous, the police furtive and seedy. Came to the town of Quevedo. Sullen violence in the mud streets, muttering gray phantoms of malaria walk the mud streets along the river. In my hotel room, 2 straw pallets on wooden bunks, copper luster pitcher, dry, dusty. A scorpion crawls slowly up the split bamboo wall. On one bunk was a young man who got up and introduced himself. He was on his way to the coast to join the Air Force.
Yo soy un pobre muchacho, pero tengo los sentimientos elevados. Yo soy hombre.
He died, testing a condemned parachute misconverted and reconverted by Track, Inc., a scandal involving a sinister Albanian fixer known as Mr. In, who got his start as a congressional lavatory attendant. Boy blood spatters the operator, massive with his weight of centuries, sit there and take his cut and never give anything back. Got the big fix up his ass with heroin, diamonds, and antibiotics. A whore, half-Negro and Chinese, with high, small breasts and white teeth, stood in the door and asked for a cigarette. She steps in and takes off her pink slip and stands naked. The boy drops his clothes and lies down naked on a pallet, chewing gum and waiting.